Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. It is Friday. I don't know if that comes as good news or like news where you're saying to yourself, oh, it's Friday. All the things I was supposed to get done this week are yet not done. So Friday comes as, this wonderful opportunity to bring the work week to an end. But for many of us, myself included, Friday sometimes arrives and I think to myself, oh my goodness, there is a long litany and list of things that I didn't get done in the past week that I certainly perceived myself to have, that I should have done. And then I look at the weekend and I say it would be wonderful to get some downtime and some rest, but I don't really necessarily see that in the next 72 hours. And so I bring us this morning just one verse from Psalm 27, verse 14. Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage. He shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. So let us wait, and let us not wait passively. Let us wait actively. Let us wait with active anticipation, because we are waiting not just on anything or anyone, but we're waiting on the Lord. So wait on the Lord, not just waiting around for anything to happen, or not just waiting around mindlessly or listlessly, but actively, with active anticipation, wait on the Lord. And in the meantime, and you already know, I call it the meantime, the time in between, and it's often mean. In the meantime, be of good courage, which means like not lagging in zeal. As the writer of Hebrews reminds us, let us lift up our drooping heads and strengthen our weak knees and make straight paths and run with perseverance and strive for peace and holiness. This is active waiting. This is waiting with active anticipation on the Lord to be who he is and do what he does and bring redemptive history around in our own lives. Let no bitterness take root, the writer of Hebrews reminds us. Do nothing unholy or immoral while you wait. So while you wait, with active anticipation on the Lord, be of good courage, anticipating that he will strengthen your heart. Now, I note there that in this verse, as we wait, and as we are promised that the Lord will strengthen our hearts, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to remove the cause of our heartache or the labor before us. And so I think that we should be mindful of that. Waiting on the Lord is not waiting for God to remove some barrier or liberate us from a particular distress. Sometimes he makes us able. He instructs the disciples to get into the boat knowing there is a storm, and he lays down in the stern and goes to sleep. Well, he intends to be with them through the storm all the way to the other side. And so let us have that confidence today in whatever storms you are facing. It may seem to you as if Christ is asleep in the stern of the ship, and you're like, what are you doing? Don't you care that I'm perishing? And he's like, why are you afraid? I'm not just the Lord of your life. I'm the Lord of the wind and the waves and the Lord of all creation. I have got this. I have got you. Wait, wait. I'll strengthen your heart. I may not remove your heartache, but I will strengthen you in the midst of it. Wait on the Lord with faith and hope and love and great expectation. That's my encouragement to each and every one of us today as we face this day and all that will be included in it. We will turn here to a conversation with Matthew Hawkins, the former public policy director for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. He joins us to talk through religious freedom headlines and life issues across the country. And so Matthew is waiting on board right now and joins us via Skype, and he and I will be right back. Well, good morning. Whatever you're facing today, let us face it together in in the mutual spirit of the Lord. And so my brother Matthew Hawkins is back. Welcome.
Good morning, Carmen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I'm well.
So first Friday of spring. I'm happy.
I know.
at least in the Tennessee region. I know.
It is.
Our friends
I know.
Up north are probably still shoveling snow.
Yes, they're looking forward to drying out, actually. And so we've got a lot of folks who are listening in regions right now that are massively flooded or anticipating flooding as the rivers rise going south. And so,
goodness gracious,
we've been talking here on the air over the last several days about that, and we will conclude the show today with a conversation with a Native American who's going to help us understand what's happening in some of our tribal areas, because we don't often hear from them in these times.
Right.
Because, you know, just frankly, you know, that's not where the media is turning its attention. And so, we got a lot of folks out there who are in real distress. And so our hearts go out to them. I've been encouraging listeners to engage as they are able in terms of offering relief. And so we've got we know that as a nation we have this massive cleanup ahead, and yes, spring planting, and so we're praying for things to dry out and farmers to recover sufficiently to be able to do that. So yes, but spring has sprung where you and I live in Middle Tennessee. Let's turn our attention to this story in Wisconsin, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Tell us what has happened in this Wisconsin religious freedom case.
Sure. Well, there appears to have been an employment dispute at a church in a suburb of Green Bay. So you're talking Packer country here. And basically, they had directed a church, made a ruling or a decision that basically said if a church opens its doors to the public, then it must play by all the public accommodation rules, including sexual orientation, gender identity laws. Thankfully, their county, the district court, ruled against them and called their forceful imposition of those laws egregious. And so we have a good news coming from out of Wisconsin that a church is welcome to propagate its beliefs and act according to its own faith convictions, even when it's opens their doors to the public. This is kind of the four walls argument that says, well, you people can do what you want among your membership as far as your four walls and your services are concerned. But as soon as you open your doors to the public to either invite people to the public or to serve people or to open a school that provides broadly to the community, then you have to play by the more secularist state rules or the state, little s state rules. And so it looks like a good decision coming out of there. We'll see if the city appeals it. I suspect they won't, but we'll see whether they dig their heels in or not.
So this is a conversation that I know attorneys are having across the country, particularly like the Christian Legal Society. I know that this is a conversation that is really forefront in their conversations about anticipating sort of a next front in the
right.
Depending on how you articulate this, it's either the civil liberties conversation or it's the religious freedom conversation.
Yeah.
And so this does appear to be a real new emerging front line of conversation for which churches and schools and other other places that tend to offer their facilities for any sort of public use. If you offer
right.
it for any public use, do you have to offer it for every public use? And I saw this arise in a conversation actually about you've heard of this drag queen story time.
I have not.
I mean, have you heard of it? Okay, so well,
you
actually have a child in this age range, so this is like now I feel like I'm informing you this morning. So there's this effort across the country in public libraries to have these drag queens come in and do reading of like pro LGBTQ, particularly part to preschoolers. And it's now not confined to public libraries. Like they are now pressing to be included in any
right.
places. Where other people get to do like readings for kids. Well, you can imagine all the places that might be included in those kinds of conversations. So I do think that this public this public accommodation conversation, how property is used, what kinds of policies local congregations have in place, how long have those been in place? Like, those are all the kinds of conversations I think that local churches need to be, and Christian schools and other institutions need to be having when we're talking about these things. So let's turn our attention to some of the pro-life legislation across particularly the southeastern United States. Let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to specifically talk about the Alabama fetal heartbeat law. But there's also news in Mississippi and Georgia and Tennessee, all related to pro-life legislation. And so I do think that folks, no matter where you live, there is an opportunity at the state level, to engage in the pro-life conversation. And those of us who are reborn, we really need to be advocating for the preborn. And so Matt Hawkins and I will continue that conversation when we come back.
I'm smelling coffee, birds are singing just outside. Here comes your mercy streaming in with the morning light.
So, Matthew Hawkins, You are always thinking about life, and you are thinking about personhood. You are you've got your finger on the pulse. Now, see, there you go, of heartbeat legislation across the country related to the pro-life movement. And in Alabama, people with a heartbeat are people. So right. So unborn or yet to be born children are legally people in Alabama. And that reality is being brought to bear right now in a pretty unique case. So why don't you tell people about it?
As of today, the governor signed that law yesterday. And actually, let me see.
So I think Mississippi's actually, the one that got signed yesterday. No, that's good. This is where I should just tell you what I'm talking about instead of imagine I'm talking about. Yeah. So in Alabama, I'm thinking about this young man who is 21 years old, and he is the first person to actually like use the Alabama heartbeat law in a case where he is representing the estate of his unborn child, baby Roe, whose life was taken in what he says is a wrongful death lawsuit. And he's brought that lawsuit against an Alabama abortion clinic and the maker of the drug, which was used to terminate the life of his child. And I love his testimony because, you know, he's saying, look, I'm here for the men who actually want to have their baby. I think I believe every child from conception is a baby and deserves to live. And he's advocating that men, that dads, have a right in this conversation. And I think it has the potential to radically change the conversation across the country.
Yeah, it really does, Carmen. And I think this is a really great up close and personal example of how men, fathers, frankly, should be involved in this conversation about abortion and life. We certainly need fathers to be fathers, and we have a detrimental patterns in this nation right now along those lines. And it starts with the care of unborn children. Backing up, the state level battle for life is very real. We saw a significant increase in state activity during the Obama administration because pro-life advocates rightfully recognized that nothing was going to happen at the federal level, even if you had a Congress that was friendly. And so what you saw was this population of abortion restrictions at the state level, wherever they could, lots of bans on 20-week at the 20-week gestation point, the point where scientifically it has been shown to cause pain to a fetus. And you have about 20 states who've enabled that kind of legislation. And what you have, and this quarter of this year, you've seen states go the opposite direction. So where you even have apparently infanticide is possible now for failed abortions, particularly in New York and Virginia almost did it, and rolled that back. So what I like to tell people is we have to pay attention to stuff at the state level, because in the American context, where the states are quote unquote the laboratories of democracy, we're finding out, kind of test driving legislation to see what might work at the federal level. And so you have legislation like the 20-week pain capable bans that are populated in about 19 to 20 states that seem really stable, frankly, in the court of law. And then you have now what and you see in Alabama and now Mississippi as of yesterday. And in Kentucky, the heartbeat bills, which basically rolls back the restrictions even further to the moment a heartbeat is detected. So that's clearly a pro-life endgame that we want to see. We recognize that that is life in there. The question is, what is legally possible, right? So the heartbeat bill certainly accords with our moral convictions and what I believe is scientifically confirmable. And then we have on the legal strategy and the legislative strategy, what's possible. So this is kind of new territory for us. So we need to watch this. But I think some of the strategy might be related to what we perceive to be a more friendly Supreme Court. So somewhere in these states, there are going to be legal conflicts. The pro-abortion industry will challenge these for sure. And so you could see some of these laws being challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court, and we'll see what the Supreme Court does with them.
So I know that, you know, there's folks who are listening this morning in Iowa, and they're thinking to themselves, hey, we're on the front of this as well in terms of heartbeat, you know, fetal heartbeat legislation. And so I do think that no matter where you live, what Matt's trying to provoke you to do is know what the law is in your state and then participate in the pro-life conversation in your state. And that's for men and for women. Like, men need to be involved in these conversations. This is not just a women's issue. Half the babies who are terminated are boys. And, you know, and so this is, if you're a feminist, this is your issue. Half the babies terminated are girls.
Exactly.
Maybe more so if there's if there's sex preferencing going on in terms of abortion. So, Matt, what else, as you sort of survey the landscape across the United States and around the world in relationship to religious liberty, I always wonder, like, what's on the radar of people like you? What are you what are you looking at? What are you paying attention to? And what's on the horizon that the rest of us should be sort of looking forward to?
Well, we've witnessed over the last couple of weeks an increase in violence against Christians, particularly in Nigeria. This place has been unstable for many years. Frank Wolf, former congressman and now one of the lead guys over at the 21 Wilberforce group, they put out a report years ago. They've been trying to get national attention on this. In international law, to be a refugee, you have to cross over a legal border, an international legal border. If not, you're what they call an internally displaced person, an IDP. Nigeria, I believe, has been at the top of that quantity of IDPs for a number of years now, people who have been run out of their homes and their towns. They're not technically refugees because they haven't crossed international boundaries, but that's basically what they are, practically speaking. And Nigeria has been just a wreck. There's kind of a dominant Islamist presence in the north, and then towards the south, it's more Christian-dominated. Religious freedom advocates internationally met in Nigeria last month to collaborate across Christian denominational lines. We'll see if that bears any fruit. And then in the Middle East now, in the Iraq and Syria region, we received word this week that ISIS, militarily speaking, has been defeated. On the one hand, that's really great news, but we're going to have to watch the ramifications of what ISIS did there, because you have while they're defeated militarily speaking, the people are still around, members of ISIS, their families, and then people who were driven out by ISIS who want to return home. You have some pretty stark and difficult societal conflicts that are going to remain for people who are trying to kill each other, basically. And this was not only Muslim extremists on minority faiths like Christians and Yazidis, but also among Muslim against Muslim violence. And so you have a culture that needs to heal. And we've seen from even our own American experience of the Civil War, how long those ramifications last. And so religious freedom advocates, I think, are going to keep in mind this former ISIS territory as we pray for our brothers and sisters and then our friends in other faiths as they try to put their lives and their communities back together.
Matthew Hawkins, thank you so much. You guys can follow him on Twitter. Are you Matt T. Hawk? Do I have that right?
M.T. Hawk.
M.T. Hawk. And you guys can follow him on Twitter. And Matt, thank you so much for the ways in which you bring the faith to bear on the conversations of the day. Thank you for your passionate concern for people, both the born and those who are reborn Christians and everybody else. Like, I love your heart. So thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Carmen. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Okay, we got to take a quick break. Actually, you know what? Hey, Paul Perreault, let's play Lighten Up. So, friends, let me encourage you again today to be waiting actively with great anticipation upon the Lord for God to be God and for God to do what God does redemptively in and through you, as he has you deployed out there in the world that he so loves to be an agent of his grace and a minister of reconciliation, an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven. If you haven't, stood with your shoulders back this morning and looked yourself in the mirror and had that conversation, now's the time to do it. Remind yourself of who you are as an image bearer of the Lord our God, as a standard bearer of Christ the King, as a person who is representing another. Let us represent Christ to the world today in ways that honor him, in ways that glorify the Father, in ways that advance the kingdom. Be gospel people always and in all ways. That's what you and I are in the world to do. So let's take that challenge on today in each and every one of the situations in which we find ourselves. Okay, so when we come back here in just a moment, I'm going to be talking with Jamie Ayton from Wheaton College. We're going to be talking about the flooding disaster in Mozambique. We're going to be talking about the flooding disaster here in the United States. And we're going to talk about how we live as faithful people in the midst of disaster. I'm Carmen LeBurge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back. So as you survey the spring, what do you have planned? I actually have a trip planned to the Twin Cities so that I can be in the studio with Paul Perreault and all of the other hosts of Faith Radio to talk with you during the week of what we call Spring Share. So April 9th to the 12th, we are going to be talking with one another about how it is that the gospel goes forth through this ministry platform, and how you are an essential component part of that, not just in the conversations that we have here on air every day, but as the system of support through which we do what we do every single day. And so Spring Share is an exciting week where we share inspiring stories of God's work in the lives of our Faith Radio listeners. So whether or not you are listening live on a terrestrial radio station in the Faith Radio network, or you are listening streaming online at myfaithradio.com, or maybe you are listening via the Faith Radio app on one of your connected devices, or you're listening to the podcast after the fact. All of those ministries are made possible by the Ministry of Faith Radio, and the Ministry of Faith Radio is made possible by listeners like you. So plan now to participate in Spring Share. It is the week of April the 9th to the 12th.
Victory in Jesus is not just the title of an old hymn. This is Jim Garlow. When Jesus went to the cross, people thought it represented the ultimate defeat, while it was in fact the ultimate victory for believers in every generation. Even today that seems counterintuitive. Various cults have tried to explain it away. Muslims have asserted that God did a quick switch and put Judas up there on the cross. If we didn't know better from Scripture, it would make more sense for the betrayer to be crucified than the sinless one. But with a full revelation, we do know better. When Christ died on the cross, Satan was defeated, our sins were paid for, and victory was assured. The cross was not God's plan being foiled. It was the plan from all eternity. Living victoriously in Christ means having a full recognition of this biblical truth. This is Jim Garlow. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
from around the world, and frankly, the news from a lot of our own live listening parts of the country today is just devastating, and the devastation is from floodwaters. And my, this seems strange to say, favorite conversation partner when it comes to disasters is Jamie Ayton. Jamie is the founder and executive director of the Humanitarian Disaster Institute and the Blanchard Chair of Humanitarian and Disaster Leadership at Wheaton College Graduate School. Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me this morning.
Does it seem weird to be the guy that I want to talk to in the face of disaster, or does that seem like a good thing to you?
You know, that actually kind of made me laugh when you described me in that way, but I have to say the my favorite thing that I've ever had said or written about me was that I was an expert in really bad things. I understand. I wasn't surprised.
So let's have you be the guy who is an expert in bringing the power of the good news to bear in really bad situations, because that's who you are in my mind. Like you help us frame disaster both at the personal level and frankly at the global level. You help us frame it in ways that that get us beyond feeling absolutely paralyzed, because I think that's you know, Jamie, when we look at what's going on in Mozambique, we look what's going on in the Midwest of the United States, we look what's going on in our own lives in terms of loss and sometimes, you know, devastating diagnoses, and we feel paralyzed. But you help get us beyond the paralysis of disaster, and that's an equipping ministry that we just need at every level of our lives today.
Well, thanks so much for those encouraging words, Carmen.
So let's start halfway around the world in Mozambique, because the headlines today, if folks were to bother to Google Mozambique, the headlines today are that, you know, hundreds of bodies are washing up on the roads. The area of impact and devastation of the flooding we think it's beyond our ability to imagine that 75% of Nebraska is underwater, but Mozambique is underwater in a whole different way. Try to help us understand the scope of what's going on in Mozambique.
What we're seeing there in Mozambique right now, the president of the country actually came out recently and said that they believe that there's been over 1,000 people that have lost their lives from this amount of flooding. And as we think about how difficult things are, you know, there's some similarities between what's happening in the Midwest and Mozambique with the flooding, being that both are areas where some of the infrastructure is under capacity, that some of the infrastructure was already weak to begin with. But then one of the important things is, as we look at how bad it is in the Midwest, now picture what regular life on an everyday basis was for Mozambique before the flood, where there was even less infrastructure, even less resources, even more poverty, and even more challenges in the country. So when you have this flooding happen, it really compounds the negative impact on the lives of those that are there.
So where folks in the Midwest of the United States, have a nation of neighbors who we will absolutely show up. When they start mucking out their homes, people from across the United States will arrive in a new flood of humanitarian support and aid. We will not let our neighbors be, we will not allow them to be like literally washed away by this. The people in Mozambique, they don't have that kind of capacity. So talk with us about when disaster strikes in a place in the world that does not have any internal capacity to respond to the needs of its own people. How then do we, as the rest of the world, need to bear the burden of that disaster response and recovery?
You know, Carmen, we absolutely have a role to play in situations like that. And one is, even though there's a lack of formal response, that those of us here in the U.S., as we watch what's happening unfold in Mozambique, is to look for those kind of natural helpers or those grassroots organizations or those community organizations or congregations that may be lifted up during this time to be able to help provide the need and care there. Another way that we can start to support those in Mozambique is to look for trusted organizations that are trained to do professional disaster relief work that have been active or doing development work there or will be deploying to go. Because by giving our prayers and our money to those sorts of organizations and the people on the ground, that can be one of the best ways that we help. You know, sometimes our tendency is to think in the immediate aftermath of something like what has happened with the flooding in Mozambique, is let's go out and collect clothes and goods and, you know, mail them overseas. But oftentimes by the time those goods reach overseas, the needs have changed so drastically that we see, like, for instance, in after the Indian flood or tsunami that happened a number of years ago, where the people there just got over inundated by these clothes and they weren't actually helpful to them, and they ended up just leaving them on the shores by the ocean. So if we're giving funds to trusted organizations, that's one of the best ways to help, because those groups are on the ground, they already have relationships, and they're able to pivot more quickly to respond to the ever rapidly changing needs on the ground.
So when we come back, Jamie, I'd like for you to make the parallels, you know, here to the U.S. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the Midwestern United States and the disaster that people are facing. And I'd love for you to equip people, you know, what are the three or four or half a dozen things that individuals who have been struck by disaster, like, what do they need to do? And then what do the rest of us outside of the disaster zone need to do as well? So my conversation partner is Jamie Ayton. He and I are talking about disaster at the personal level and at the community level and at the global level, how we as individuals can respond when the disaster is our own and when the disaster happens to our neighbor. You can find Jamie at the Wheaton Humanitarian Disaster Institute. He is the founder and executive director. We'll be right back. So we're talking with Jamie Ayton about all things disastrous and how we can respond faithfully in the midst of disaster. He is some books that are out there that you might want to check out as you are trying to respond to disaster, not only in your own life, but helping others facing disasters. The Disaster Ministry Handbook continues to be a really great resource. You can also check out what Jamie is doing and offering online and at Wheaton through the Humanitarian Disaster Institute at Wheaton College, and that's in Illinois, but their stuff is available really widely. So let me encourage you to access that. Jamie, when folks are facing disaster, give us some, not just talking points, but give us some walking points. What should we do?
When individuals are going through a disaster, you know, oftentimes, Carmen, it can really turn our world upside down, that our sense of security and safety can go out the window. And it oftentimes leaves us with a lot of why questions that can sometimes actually almost paralyze us, as we're almost in shock about not being able to believe what has just happened in our lives. And I just want listeners who may be going through these floods to know that those are all normal responses. And that if you're struggling right now, whether it's emotionally or spiritually, that God is still with you, and just encourage you to cling to your faith and to hope in God during these difficult times. You know, one of the things that our institute has found in disasters all over the globe has been that those who are able to engage their faith in positive ways, that actually helps to cultivate greater resilience. You know, a few other things is make sure that you don't try to walk through this disaster on your own, but to remember that recovery always takes place in community. It can be easy to want to isolate ourselves and pull away from others after a disaster. But again, in the research and the work that we've done, we've been able to see firsthand how important those relationships are to our ability to go forward and make progress after a disaster. Something else that I would really encourage listeners who maybe have been impacted to remember is that it's also important to try to make meaning out of what has happened to us. That look for purpose, look for ways to help others, but that's also going to help yourself.
So I appreciate the way that you make it so simple, right? So I think that our tendency sometimes is to hide the fact that we are experiencing some kind of disaster, and you really encourage us to seek spiritual community, to engage in what you describe as spiritual surrender. I think that I can't remember where you have said this, but this idea that I kind of have to get to the place where I recognize that in order to see the stars, God had to take the roof off or something like that, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And once the roof is off, you can see the stars. And that seems like a real place of surrender.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, that what you're sharing there was after Hurricane Sandy, there was a survivor where a relief organization had come up to help, and you know, the house was pretty devastated and the roof was completely gone, and they expected this person to just be in shambles. And when they, you know, met him, he ended up saying, well, you know, sometimes you have to lose the roof to be able to see the stars, and that, you know, by going through these difficulties that he was able to actually grow from them. But we also have to be careful not to romanticize suffering, that sometimes growth can take a long time and doesn't always come. It's not always guaranteed in this lifetime. And so as we're going through this, that spiritual surrender part that you talked about is so key, that we need to do everything that we can, but at the same time, we need to recognize what's out of our control and to give that up to God. You know, I oftentimes think about, there was a cartoonist after Hurricane Katrina, which I had gone through after just moving to South Mississippi. And I remember this person had written about somebody who was captured in a flood. And they were saying, you know, God, give me a sign that you're here to rescue me. And it showed somebody that had come and, you know, given them a signal to evacuate. And then it was like, God, give me a sign of what I need to do to get out of here and to be safe. And then God sends a ambulance. And then it's like, God, give me a sign of what needs to be done so I know what to do. And God sends somebody on a boat to help get them out. And, you know, the cartoonist was trying to show this fact that we also have to take responsibility to do what we can, but then to recognize when it goes beyond what we have control over and to really entrust with even what we don't know to God.
So you have endured disasters with others, alongside others as a neighbor. You have endured your own personal, really devastating, or potentially devastating. I don't know. It was devastating at the time, right? You have emerged through it. Does it continue? Does a cancer diagnosis? Yeah. Does a cancer diagnosis, like, is it forever kind of devastating?
You know, it really varies. I had met somebody, you know, that I think the best explanation I ever heard wasn't mine. It was somebody else that I had met. I was giving a talk to a group of survivors at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center out in Seattle a couple of years ago. And it was so ironic to me that I was going to go back, and it was for my 3-year scan. So I'd been 3 years without any evidence of disease. And I'm in the waiting room waiting to go back for my scan. And it had taken me 20 minutes to be able to get out of my car just to walk into the cancer center because I was so anxious about getting this. And even once I was there, it was all I could do to fight back tears of feeling just so overwhelmed of what if the cancer has come back. And as I'm sitting there, I put on my headphones and I decided I'm going to check some email to try to distract myself. And there in my inbox is an invitation from this cancer center asking me to be the keynote speaker on a conference of survivorship. Mm. And Carmen, I felt so phony in that moment. And I started to cry because here I am in the waiting room as a survivor, and I'm tearful and I'm anxious, and yet I'm being asked to come to talk to other survivors about how to do survivorship. But that conference was so healing to me because I realized, talking to hundreds of other survivors, that what I was going through, that's a normal experience, and they had all gone through the same sort of thing, and that it's really difficult. And there was this survivor there that I met whose words really impacted me, where she talked about how cancer is, once you've got that diagnosis, that it's like a hoodie that you can never take off, that there's some days that you wake up and you forget that you're wearing, you know, the hoodie with that type of heavy sweatshirt. And then there's other days that you wake up and that cancer diagnosis that you had, even if you've not been had any signs of it for years, that sometimes that hoodie comes up over your face and the drawstrings are pulled and the sleeves come down over your hands and it comes across you like a straitjacket and you feel like you can't breathe. But then it's our job every day to do our best to try to pull down the hood and to push up the sleeves and to learn how to live with the hoodie so that we can still have life even amidst the anxiety that many cancer survivors live with.
Jamie, that is so hopeful and encouraging. Where on social media are you encouraging people to engage directly with you?
Several different places. I'm very active on Twitter. And by the way, your posts yesterday were making me laugh as well as informing me. So I appreciate the wide range of things you share on social media. So I'm active on Twitter. I'm also on the internet at Jamie Ayton. humanitariandisasters.com, and you can also find out more information at the Humanitarian Disaster Institute.
Great. Jamie, thank you so much. And, you know, maybe we can talk when it's not like we're always in the midst of a disaster. We could talk anytime.
That sounds great.
Yeah, thanks for bringing the gospel to bear, even on the very great challenges that we face every single day. All right, friends, let's pause for the news, and then let's rejoin one another for a second hour of Mornings with Carmen. So I get a series of emails in the morning from a number of different what are called news aggregators, and they all tell me the things that they think I need to know for the day. And everybody is leading off pretty much with the Trump administration's recognition of Israel's authority or sovereignty in the disputed Golan Heights. So we will absolutely turn our attention to that the first of the week. We're not going to turn our attention to that today. So just put that off in your mind for a couple of days. And we have folks who are using social media in the government to communicate with foreign leaders. Let me just go ahead and say the WhatsApp app is not a safe place to be exchanging information that is sensitive in any way. And so we're going to have a social media conversation. We always love to talk about media, including social media trends and things, with Adam Holtz. He's actually going to be here next. We're going to be talking about the small screen. We're going to be talking about the big screen. We're going to be talking about social media and its influence on our culture today. Obviously, Brexit is still leading the headlines, and we'll certainly talk about that on Monday with our good friend, Dr. Aiken. All right, so we got to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with Adam Holtz about all things big and small screen. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBerge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.